For thousands of years, great political thinkers of East and West tried to harmonize human differences. For Confucius, society was like his conception of a family, extensions of a ruling father and obedient sons, devoted husbands and faithful wives, benign masters and loyal servants. People were defined by their place, whether in the family or the community. So too for the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, place was all. All the great religious traditions define a place for everyone, if not on earth, then in heaven. Society was to be ruled by the virtuous and wise few. The everyday business of the community fell to the less worthy multitude, with the most menial chores left to the slaves. Neither the Greek Democrats nor the Roman Republicans believed that all men are created equal, nor did the great Hindu thinkers of the Asian subcontinent, where one's work defined one's caste, which in turn circumscribed every other aspect of life. The ancients accepted the basic premise that people differ fundamentally and importantly, and searched for ways in which people could contentedly serve the community, or the monarch, or the tyrant, or the gods, rather than themselves, despite their differences. Philosophers argued about obligations and duties, what they are, and on whom they fall. In our historical era, political philosophers have argued instead about rights. They do so because they are trying to solve a different problem. The great transformation from a search for duties and obligations to a search for rights may be dated to Thomas Hobbes, writing in the mid-1600s about a principle whereby all people, not just the rich and well-born, might have equal rights to liberty. His successor in English political thought, John Locke, conceived of people in a state of nature as being in a state also of equality, and sought to preserve that condition in actual societies through a strictly limited government. What Locke propounded is especially pertinent here because it was his theory that the American founders brought into reality. Locke recognized that there are cognitive differences among people and was strikingly harsh in his judgment about their size, but that does not mean he believed people to have different rights. People are equal in rights, Locke proclaimed, though they be unequal in everything else. Those rights, however, are negative rights, to impose contemporary terminology. They give all human beings the right not to have certain things done to them by the state or by other human beings, not the right to anything except freedom of action. This way of putting it is out of tune with the modern sensibility. Today, the original concept of equal rights is said to be meaningless cant, outmoded. Taking equal rights seriously, it is thought, requires enforcing equal outcomes. The prevailing political attitude is so dismissive toward the older conception of equal rights that it is difficult to think of serious public treatments of it. The founders just didn't think hard enough about that problem, it seems to be assumed. We are asking that you consider the alternative, that the founders were fully aware of how unequal people are, that they did not try to explain away natural inequalities, and that they nonetheless thought the best way for people to live together was under a system of equal rights. The founders wrote frankly about the inequality of men. For Thomas Jefferson, it was obvious that they were especially unequal in virtue and intelligence. The other founders, including Hamilton and Washington, also ruminated about the inequality of men and the political implications of that inequality. In doing so, they were following an ancient tradition. Political philosophers have always begun from the understanding that good policy must be in accordance with what is good for human beings, and that what is good for humans must be based on an understanding of how they are similar and how they differ. The founders saw that making a stable and just government was difficult precisely because men were unequal in every respect except their right to advance their own interests. The task of government was to set unequal persons into a system of laws and procedures that would, as nearly as possible, equalize their rights while allowing their differences to express themselves. The result would not necessarily be serene or quiet, but it would be just, and it might even work. In reminding you of these views of the men who founded America, we are not appealing to their historical eminence, but to their wisdom. We think they were right. The egalitarian ideal of contemporary political theory underestimates the importance of the differences that separate human beings. It fails to come to grips with human variation. It overestimates the ability of political interventions to shape human character and capacities. People who are free to behave differently from one another in the important affairs of daily life inevitably generate the social, and economic inequalities that egalitarianism seeks to suppress. To reduce inequality of condition, the state must impose greater and greater uniformity. In our view, the logic of the egalitarian ideal ultimately leads to tyranny. The same atmosphere prevails on a smaller scale wherever equality comes to serve as the basis for a diffuse moral outlook. Consider the many small tyrannies in America's contemporary universities, where it has become objectionable to say that some people are superior to other people in any way that is relevant to life in society. Nor is this outlook confined to judgments about people. In art, literature, ethics, and cultural norms, differences are not to be judged. Such relativism has become the moral high ground for many modern commentators on life and culture. We think that rights are embedded in our freedom to act, not in the obligations we may impose on others to act. That equality of rights is crucial, while equality of outcome is not. That concepts such as virtue, excellence, beauty, and truth should be reintroduced into moral discourse. We are comfortable with the idea that some things are better than others, not just according to our subjective point of view, but according to enduring standards of merit and inferiority. And at the same time, we reject the thought that we, or anyone else, should have the right to impose those standards. We are enthusiastic about diversity, the rich, unending diversity that free human beings generate as a matter of course, not the imposed diversity of group quotas. As we approach the policy implications of all we have discussed so far, we bring to our recommendations a predisposition. Believing that the original American conceptions of human equality and the pursuit of happiness still offer the wisest guidance for thinking about how to run today's America. Let us return to our original question. How should policy deal with the twin realities that people differ in intelligence for reasons that are not their fault, and that intelligence has a powerful bearing on how well people do in life? The answer turns us back to the ancient concern with place. The broadest goal is a society in which people throughout the functional range of intelligence can find, and feel they have found, a valued place for themselves. For valued place, we offer a pragmatic definition. You occupy a valued place if other people would miss you if you were gone. The fact that you would be missed means that you are valued. To have many different people who would miss you, in many different parts of your life and at many levels of intensity, is a hallmark of a person whose place is well and thoroughly valued. One way of thinking about policy options is to ask whether they aid or obstruct this goal of creating valued places. The great bulk of the American population is amply equipped in their cognitive resources and in other personal characteristics to find valued places in society. We must emphasize that because through much of this program we have focused on people at the two tails of the bell curve. Now is a good time to recall the people in the broad part of the curve between the extremes. The prevalence of the social maladies we reviewed was strikingly concentrated in the bottom IQ deciles. By the time people were even approaching average IQ, the percentages of people who were poor, had babies out of wedlock, provided poor environments for their children, or exhibited any other problem constituted small percentages of the population. Translated into the themes we are about to introduce, the evidence supports the proposition that most people by far have enough intelligence for getting on with the business of life. We believe the policies we advocate will benefit them as well by creating a generally richer and more vital society, but it should be made explicit. Our solutions assume that the average American is an asset, not part of the problem. Nonetheless, millions of Americans have levels of cognitive ability low enough to make their lives statistically much more difficult than life is for most other people. How may policy help or obstruct them as they go about their lives? Our thesis is that it used to be easier for people who are low in ability to find a valued place than it is now. In a simpler America, being comparatively low in the qualities measured by IQ did not necessarily affect the ability to find a valued niche in society. Many such people worked on farms. People who would score 80 or 90 on an IQ test could be competent farm workers, not conspicuously distinguished from most other people in wealth, home, neighborhood, or status in the community. Much the same could be said of a wide variety of skilled and unskilled trades. Inevitably, with technological advances, the niches for the less intelligent have shrunk. Out of the myriad things that have changed since the beginning of the century, two overlapping phenomena have most affected people with modest abilities. It has become harder to earn a living to support the valued roles of spouse, parent, and neighbor, but even more importantly, functions have been stripped from one main source of valued place, the neighborhood. Communities are rich and vital places to the extent that they engage their members in the stuff of life: birth, death, raising children, making a living, helping friends, coping with problems, setting examples, welcoming, chastising, celebrating, and negotiating. If there is one theme on which both observers from left and right recently sound very much alike, it is that something vital and important has drained out of American communities. Most adults need something to do with their lives other than going to work, and that something consists of being stitched into a fabric of family and community. The cognitive elite may not detect the declining vitality in the local community. Their lives are centered outside a geographic community. Their professional associates and friends may be scattered over miles of suburbs, or for that matter, across the nation and the world. For large segments of American society, however, the geographic neighborhood is the major potential resource for infusing life with much of its meaning. The massive transfer of functions from the locality to the government has stripped neighborhoods of their traditionally shared tasks. Instead, we have neighborhoods that are merely localities, not communities of people tending to their communal affairs. Valued places in a neighborhood are created only to the extent that the people in a neighborhood have valued tasks to do. Thus arises our first general policy prescription. A wide range of social functions should be restored to the neighborhood when possible, and otherwise to the municipality. The reason for doing so is not to save money, not even because such services will be provided more humanely and efficiently by neighborhoods, though we believe that generally to be the case, but because this is one of the best ways to multiply the valued places that people can fill. In a decent post-industrial society, neighborhoods shall not have lost their importance as a source of human satisfactions and as a generator of valued places that all sorts of people can fill. Government policy can do much to foster the vitality of neighborhoods by trying to do less for them. Our second policy prescription proposes a simplification of rules. As of the end of the 20th century, the United States is run by rules that are congenial to people with high IQs and that make life more difficult for everyone else. This is true in the areas of criminal justice, marriage and divorce, welfare and tax policy, business law, among others. It is true of rules that have been intended to help ordinary people, rules that govern schooling, medical practice, the labeling of foods. In looking for examples, the 1040 income tax form is such an easy target that it need only be mentioned to make the point. But the same complications and confusions apply to a single woman with children seeking government assistance or a person who is trying to open a dry cleaning shop. These systems have been created bit by bit over decades by people who think that complicated, sophisticated operationalizations of fairness, justice, and right and wrong are ethically superior to simple black-and-white versions. Additionally, complex systems are precisely the ones that give the cognitive elite the greatest competitive advantage. Deciphering complexity is one of the things that cognitive ability is most directly good for. Our policy recommendation is to strip away the nonsense. Return to the assumption that in America the government has no business getting in people's way, except for the most compelling reasons, with compelling required to meet a stiff definition. Simpler rules would also make it easier for people to lead virtuous lives. We start with the supposition that almost everyone is capable of being a morally autonomous human being most of the time and given suitable circumstances. This reflects an old but lately unfashionable truth, that human beings in general are capable of deciding between right and wrong. This does not mean, however, that everyone is capable of deciding between right and wrong with the same sophistication and nuances. The difference between people of low cognitive ability and the rest of society may be put in terms of a metaphor. Everyone has a moral compass, but some of those compasses are more susceptible to magnetic storms than others. For example, imagine living in a society where the rules about crime are simple and the consequences are equally simple. Crime consists of a few obviously wrong acts: assault, rape, murder, robbery, theft, trespass, destruction of another's property, fraud. Someone who commits a crime is probably caught and almost certainly punished. The punishment almost certainly hurts, therefore it is meaningful. Punishment follows arrest quickly within a matter of days or weeks. The members of the society subscribe to the underlying codes of conduct with enthusiasm and near unanimity. They teach and enforce them whenever appropriate. Living in such a world, the moral compass shows simple, easily understood directions. North is north, south is south, right is right, wrong is wrong. Now, imagine that all the rules are made more complicated. The number of acts defined as crimes has multiplied, so that many things that are crimes are not nearly as obviously wrong as something like robbery or assault. The link between moral transgression and committing crime is made harder to understand. Fewer crimes lead to an arrest. Fewer arrests lead to prosecution. Many times the prosecutions are not for something the accused person did, but for an offense that the defense lawyer and the prosecutor agreed upon. Many times, people who are prosecuted are let off, though everyone, including the accused, acknowledges that the person was guilty. When people are convicted, the consequences have no apparent connection to how much harm they have done. These events are typically spread out over months and sometimes years. The two worlds we have described are not far removed from the contrast between the criminal justice system in the United States as recently as the 1950s and that system as of the 1990s. We are arguing that a person with comparatively low intelligence, whose time horizon is short and ability to balance many competing and complex incentives is low, has much more difficulty following a moral compass in the 1990s than he would have had in the 1950s. Put aside your feelings about whether these changes in the criminal justice system represent progress. Simply consider them as a magnetic storm, as a set of changes that make the needle pointing to right and wrong waver erratically if you happen to be looking at the criminal justice system from the perspective of a person who is not especially bright. Our policy prescription is that the criminal justice system should be made simpler. The meaning of criminal offenses used to be clear and objective, and so were the consequences. It is worth trying to make them so again. Of all the uncomfortable topics we have explored, a pair of the most uncomfortable ones are that a society with a higher mean IQ is also likely to be a society with fewer social ills and brighter economic prospects, and that the most efficient way to raise the IQ of a society is for smarter women to have higher birth rates than duller women. Instead, America is going in the opposite direction, and the implication is a future America with more social ills and gloomier economic prospects. These conclusions follow directly from the evidence we have presented, and yet we have so far been silent on what to do about it. We are silent partly because we are as apprehensive as most other people about what might happen when a government decides to social engineer who has babies and who doesn't. We can imagine no recommendation for using the government to manipulate fertility that does not have dangers. But this highlights the problem. The United States already has policies that inadvertently social engineer who has babies, and it is encouraging the wrong women. If the United States did as much to encourage high IQ women to have babies as it now does to encourage low IQ women, it would rightly be described as engaging in aggressive manipulation of fertility. The technically precise description of America's fertility policy is that it subsidizes births among poor women who are also disproportionately at the low end of the intelligence distribution. We urge generally that these policies, represented by the extensive network of cash and services for low-income women who have babies, be ended. The government should stop subsidizing births to anyone, rich or poor. The other generic recommendation, as close to harmless as any government program we can imagine, is to make it easy for women to make good on their prior decision not to get pregnant by making available birth control mechanisms that are increasingly flexible, foolproof, inexpensive, and safe. The other demographic factor we discussed earlier was immigration, and the evidence that recent waves of immigrants are, on the average, less successful and probably less able than earlier waves. An immigrant population with low cognitive ability will, again on the average, have trouble not only finding good work, but have trouble in school, at home, and with the law. We believe that the main purpose of immigration law should be to serve America's interests. It should be among the goals of public policy to shift the flow of immigrants away from those admitted under the nepotistic rules, which broadly encourage the reunification of relatives, and toward those admitted under competency rules already established in immigration law, not to the total exclusion of nepotistic and humanitarian criteria but a shift. Perhaps our central thought about immigration is that present policy assumes an indifference to the individual characteristics of immigrants that no society can indefinitely maintain without danger. At the beginning of this program, we asked the question, what good can come from understanding the relationship of intelligence to social structure and public policy? We have tried to answer this question in many ways. Our first answer has been implicit. For 30 years, vast changes in American life have been instituted by the federal government to deal with social problems. We have tried to point out what a small segment of the population accounts for such a large proportion of those problems. To the extent that the problems of this small segment are susceptible to social engineering solutions at all, they should be highly targeted. The vast majority of Americans can run their own lives just fine, and policy should, above all, be constructed so that it permits them to do so. Our second answer, also implicit, has been that just about any policy in any area, education, employment, welfare, criminal justice, or the care of children, can profit if its designers ask how the policy accords with the wide variation in cognitive ability. Policies may fail not because they are inherently flawed, but because they do not make allowances for how much people vary. There are hundreds of ways to frame bits and pieces of public policy so that they are based on a realistic appraisal of the responses they will get, not from people who think like Rhodes Scholars, but from people who think in simpler ways. Our third answer has been that group differences in cognitive ability, so desperately denied for so long, can best be handled, can only be handled, by a return to individualism. A person should not be judged as a member of a group, but as an individual. With that cornerstone of the American doctrine once again in place, group differences can take their appropriately insignificant place in affecting American life. But until that cornerstone is once again in place, the anger, the hurt, and the animosities will continue to grow. Once, we as a nation absorbed people of different cultures, abilities, incomes, and temperaments into communities that worked. The nation was good at it precisely because of, not in spite of, the freedom that American individuals and communities enjoyed. Have there been exceptions to that generalization? Yes, predominantly involving race, and the nation rightly moved to rid itself of the enforced discrimination that lay behind those exceptions. Is the generalization nonetheless justified? Overwhelmingly so, in our judgment. Reducing that freedom has enervated our national genius for finding valued places for everyone. The genius will not be revitalized until the freedom is restored. Cognitive partitioning will continue. It cannot be stopped because the forces driving it cannot be stopped. But America can choose to preserve a society in which every citizen has access to the central satisfactions of life. Its people can, through an interweaving of choice and responsibility, create valued places for themselves in their worlds. They can live in communities, urban or rural, where being a good parent, a good neighbor, and a good friend will give their lives meaning and purpose. They can weave the most crucial safety nets together, so that their mistakes and misfortunes are mitigated and withstood with a little help from their friends. All of these good things are available now to those who are smart enough or rich enough, if they can exploit the complex rules to their advantage, buy their way out of the social institutions that no longer function, and have access to the rich human interconnections that are growing, not diminishing, for the cognitively fortunate. We are calling upon our listeners to recognize the ways in which public policy has come to deny these good things to those who are not smart enough and rich enough. At the heart of our thought is the quest for human dignity. The central measure of success for this government, as for any other, is to permit people to live lives of dignity. Not to give them dignity, for that is not in any government's power, but to make it accessible to all. That is one way of thinking about what the founders had in mind when they proclaimed, as a truth self-evident, that all men are created equal. That is what we have in mind when we talk about valued places for everyone. Inequality of endowments, including intelligence, is a reality. Trying to pretend that inequality does not really exist has led to disaster. Trying to eradicate inequality with artificially manufactured outcomes has led to disaster. It is time for America once again to try living with inequality as life is lived. Understanding that each human being has strengths and weaknesses, qualities we admire and qualities we do not admire, competencies and incompetencies, assets and debits, that the success of each human life is not measured externally but internally, that of all the rewards we can confer on each other, the most precious is a place as a valued fellow citizen.
This presentation of The Bell Curve, written by Richard J. Hernstein and Charles Murray, is a Simon & Schuster audio program. The Bell Curve is also available in hardcover from the Free Press.